Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is November 10th, 2021, and I'm your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is How Did I Get Epi Alone? Vasopressin and Methylprednisolone for In-Hospital Cardiac Arrests. And our guest skeptic is Dr. Neil Dasgupta. He is an emergency physician and ED intensivist from Long Island, New York, and currently an assistant clinical professor and director of emergency critical care at Nassau University Medical Center. Welcome to the SGEM, Neil.
Thanks, Ken. It is an absolute pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for having me on. Although I'm pretty sure I'm only here because my wife made you invite me.
Yeah, your wife, Dr. Suchi Data, was on the SGEM recently with a very powerful episode on gender inequity in the House of Medicine. And Neil, I gotta say, she set the bar really high for you.
This is true. I can't hope to live up to that performance. You guys did a great job with a really important topic. Your listeners today will have to settle for a much more boring topic with me, resuscitation and cardiac arrest and vasopressors.
Well, I've been in contact with Suchi, you know, behind the scenes, doing a little DMing and stuff like that. And she told me, happy birthday for tomorrow, Neil.
Thank you so much. She's definitely the secret undercover kind of person. So I'm not surprised she did that.
Well, let's get started with a case to set up this whole episode that we're doing on using vasopressin and steroids for in-hospital cardiac arrest. So what case do you want to start with?
So let's say you're working overnight and you hear a code blue called for a 71-year-old male inpatient. This patient's boarding in the emergency department as happens so frequently now. He's been admitted the night before for a new diagnosis of rapid atrial fibrillation. He has a history of hypertension, dyslipidemia, and type 2 diabetes. His medications include a beta blocker, a statin, angiotensin converting enzyme inhibitor, metformin, aspirin, and a direct oral anticoagulant, a DOAC. You arrive and you see that the advanced cardiac life support algorithm is being followed for adult cardiac arrest patients with pulseless electrical activity, or PEA. Cardiopulmonary resuscitation, CPR, is in progress. The monitor shows a non-shockable rhythm. Epinephrine is provided and you quickly place an advanced airway. A second dose of epinephrine is given, and you start to think about reversible causes and your next steps for in-hospital cardiac arrests.
Neil, we've looked at in-hospital cardiac arrests a couple of times on the SGEM. The first time we looked at this issue was on SGEM number 50. And this was also the first SGEM Journal Club done, where Dr. William Osler started the Journal Club initiative at McGill University. We reviewed a randomized, double-blinded, placebo-controlled parallel group trial done in three Greek tertiary hospitals. This trial, which had 268 patients, so relatively small, reported an increase in return of spontaneous circulation, or ROSC, and also an increase in survival to hospital discharge with good neurologic function, with vasopressin, steroids, an epinephrine, or a VSE protocol, and that was compared to epinephrine alone. We felt at the time that this was really interesting, but it would need to be validated or replicated before changing our in-hospital cardiac arrest protocols.
Corticosteroids have been suggested as a possible therapy in these cardiac arrest situations. A systematic review and meta-analysis published in 2020 on the use of steroids after cardiac arrest reported an increase in return of spontaneous circulation and survival to discharge, but it was limited by the availability of adequately high-powered randomized control trials.
And just a year later, so this year in 2021, we covered another systematic review meta-analysis that looked at the same issue of whether the use of corticosteroids impact neurologic outcome and mortality in patients with cardiac arrest. This was SGEM number 329. the authors reported a statistical increase in good neurologic outcome and survival to hospital discharge with steroids, but not survival at 1 year or longer. This study provided weak evidence in support of using corticosteroids for in-hospital cardiac arrest as part of the VSE protocol, vasopressin, steroids, and epinephrine.
You know, answering clinical questions about cardiac arrest with clinical trials has always been fraught with difficulty. However, cardiac arrest is something that we regularly treat in the emergency department. We need more high-quality data to inform our care. Vasopressin has been included as a part of the American Heart Association's Advanced Cardiac Life Support Protocol for quite a while, but it was removed in favor of a vasopressor monotherapy strategy with epinephrine. The tide is now shifting resuscitation research to shift our focus from obtaining return of spontaneous circulation to measuring functionality and good neurologic outcomes. After paramedic 2, in the context of questioning epinephrine's role in ACLS, advanced cardiac life support, we take a look at using the VSE protocol in cardiac arrest.
So Neil, what's the clinical question we're going to try to answer on this SGEM podcast?
So we'd like to ask, does adding a combination of vasopressin and methylprednisolone increase the chance of achieving return of spontaneous circulation in cardiac arrest?
And what's the reference?
We're looking at this paper from Anderson et al., Effect of Vasopressin and Methylprednisolone versus Placebo on Return of Spontaneous Circulation in Patients with In-Hospital Cardiac Arrest, which was in JAMA in September 2021.
Yeah, so this was just published a couple of months ago. Let's go through the PCOT. Remember, I've updated my PICO statement to PCOT. That's Population Intervention Comparison Outcome, and the T is for trial design. So what's the population?
We're looking at adult patients, 18 years of age and older, with an in-hospital cardiac arrest.
Yeah, they excluded the OCAs, the out-of-hospital cardiac arrests, and patients who had a valid do not resuscitate order, invasive mechanical circulatory support, and known or suspected pregnancy at the time of cardiac arrest. Suchi's not going to like that exclusion.
No, you guys spend a lot of time talking about how women, especially special case women, should be included in these things so we have better data.
Yeah, okay. So what was the intervention?
So they gave vasopressin 20 units and methylprednisolone 40 milligrams as soon as possible after the first dose of epinephrine, followed by another vasopressin 20 units after each epinephrine up to four doses.
And what did they compare it to?
Placebo of normal saline in identical containers as the study drugs.
All right, let's go through the outcomes. What was their primary outcome of interest for this trial?
The primary outcome was return of spontaneous circulation, defined as no further need of chest compressions for at least 20 minutes.
And then they had some secondary outcomes, and those were 30-day survival and 30-day survival with favorable neurologic outcome. And they defined favorable neurologic outcome as a cerebral performance category or CPC score of 1 or 2. All right, now that final T of the PCOT, what was the trial design?
This was a multi-center, single-nation, randomized, placebo-controlled, parallel group, double-blind superiority trial. There's a lot of good words in there, Ken.
There are indeed. Okay, here are the author's conclusions. Quote, among patients with in-hospital cardiac arrest, administration of vasopressin and methylprednisolone compared with placebo significantly increased the likelihood of return of spontaneous circulation. However, there is uncertainty whether this treatment results in benefit or harm for long-term survival. End of quote. All right, Neil, we've got 11 quality checklist questions for RCT. So let's go through those randomized clinical trial quality checklist questions. The first question is always, did this study population include or focused on those in the emergency department?
It's not focused on the emergency department. These were in-hospital cardiac arrests, But emergency physicians are often part of the Code Blue response teams, and arrests that occurred in the ED were included in this study. So not precisely, but not exactly a complete tangent either.
All right. Well, were the patients adequately randomized in this trial?
Yes. So they were randomized. Patients were randomized 1-to-1 using a random number generator to either the vasopressin and methylprednisolone group or placebo group in blocks with random sizes of 2, 4, or 6. The randomization was stratified according to site.
Yeah, so it sounds like they did a really good job of randomization. How about the process of randomization? Did they conceal it from people?
Yes, they did.
And then did they do an intention to treat analysis? Did they analyze the patients into the groups to which they were randomized?
Yep, yes, they did.
Did they recruit consecutively?
We think so. So we're assuming that they did, but it wasn't actually explicitly stated in the published manuscript or in any of the supplemental material or trial registry.
Yeah, and I'm going to bring up selection bias when we start talking nerdy, but I don't want to spill the beans already. So let's get to question number 6. The patients in both groups, were they similar with respect to prognostic factors?
Yes.
Was it a triple-blinded study where the patients, clinicians, and outcome assessors were unaware of group allocation?
Yeah, it looks like they did a pretty good job with that.
Were all groups treated equally except for the intervention?
Yes, they were.
And how about their follow-up? Did they get at least 80% in both groups?
This was really impressive. There was a 100% follow-up. There was no loss to follow-up.
All right, question 10. All patient-important outcomes were considered.
They were, and many were tertiary outcomes, including the modified Rankin scale, the Glasgow outcome score extended, and the healthcare quality of life, all at 30 days, 90 days, 180 days, and 1 year.
All right. The typical final and 11th question is the treatment effect large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
No, I don't think it was.
And I started this section by saying there was 11 quality checklists, but for season number 10, I'm trying to introduce one more question at the end of the quality checklist. And that's about financial conflicts of interest, because we do have published research that shows financial conflicts of interest, while not making the data or interpretation wrong, can influence or bias. And what I mean by bias is something that systematically moves us away from the truth of the best point estimate. So I've added a 12th question for the randomized control trial checklist, and that is, were there any financial conflicts of interest in this study?
There were. Multiple authors discussed financial conflict of interest with several pharmaceutical companies. Empresin and corresponding placebo ampules were provided free of charge by Amarmed Pharma.
All right. Well, that's the quality checklist. It's time to dig into the results. They recruited and analyzed 501 patients with a mean age of 71 years. About two-thirds were male, and two-thirds were on a medical ward. Neil, what was the key result?
The key result is more return of spontaneous circulation was achieved with the VSC protocol compared to epinephrine alone, but this did not translate into better long-term survival or with favorable neurologic outcome.
All right, let's unpack that a bit. Their primary outcome, as we mentioned, was ROSC, return of spontaneous circulation. What was the difference that they found?
There was 42% that made the primary outcome in the intervention group versus 33% in the control group.
Yeah, and the absolute difference was 9.6% with a risk ratio of 1.3. And both of these data points were statistically significant when you look at their 95% confidence intervals. How about their secondary outcomes?
Well, there was no statistical difference between the groups for both key secondary outcomes.
And to remind people, those were survival at 90 days, no statistical difference, and a favorable neurologic outcome, a very patient-oriented outcome, at 30 days, no statistical difference. All right, time for my favorite section, You ready to talk nerdy to me, Neil?
Of course. This is what I'm here for.
I love entering the nerd zone. So I'll kick it off with the first point. And this was about emergency department patients. These are not emergency department patients, but they were often emergency physicians who were responsible. In many hospitals, the only in-house physician at certain times is in the emergency department and will be responding to code blues. This is very typical for where I work in community hospitals and rural hospitals. Sometimes during the day, I will be the only physician in the building. And certainly at night, I am the only physician in the building. So we need to be cautious not to overinterpret the data and directly apply it to patients who arrive to the emergency department and have a cardiac arrest. This data can help inform our care. It can guide our care, but it certainly shouldn't dictate our care.
I hear what you're saying, Ken, but these might be more like our patients than we think. Digging into the demographics of the included patients, they seem like a surprisingly healthy cohort for in-hospital cardiac arrest. Renal replacement therapy for only 11 and 8% in the two groups, mechanical ventilation in 8 versus 11%, and vasopressors in 5 versus 9%. Only 10% versus 7% of patients were in the ICU, and 8% versus 14% were in the emergency department. This may actually help us to better extract its applicability to the emergency department population and what gets brought in via EMS. It may also be a result of the inclusion-exclusion criteria setup that I know you want to talk about a little bit more.
Yeah, that's nerdy point number two, and that's about enrollment. This was surprisingly low. They had 2,300 plus screened patients, and that got down to 512 randomized patients, and then 501 ultimately included in the analysis. And there were lots of exclusions, despite a liberal inclusion criteria and limited exclusion criteria. Large numbers of patients were excluded for not receiving epinephrine, return of spontaneous circulation, or ROSC, prior to getting the drug. And then there was a whole series of clinical team-dependent factors. You know, they forgot that the study was underway, early termination of the code, and then physicians' preferences or logistics. Now, while the authors claim this did not have an impact on outcome, it does introduce some subjectivity into there. And it's hard to imagine that it didn't have any impact on the included cohort or introduce at least some selection bias.
Our next talking nerdy point is patient-oriented outcome. So the endpoint of return of spontaneous circulation is patient-centered and a prerequisite for a good neurologic function. However, it is not a net benefit to save more people who have a poor quality of life. This is what was demonstrated in the Paramedic 2 trial that Ken, you covered in SGEM 238. There was an increase in survivors with epinephrine for out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, but unfortunately, the increase was mainly for patients having severe neurologic impairment, which was more common among survivors in the epinephrine groups compared to the placebo group. That was 31% versus 17.8%.
Well, Neil, I'm glad you mentioned POO, because I like to talk about POO. And POO stands for patient-oriented outcomes. And the outcome measure for favorable neurologic outcome in this study was the CPC, the cerebral performance category score. The legend of emergency medicine, Dr. Ian Steele from Ottawa, published some data from his classic OPALS trial. They said that while the CPC, the cerebral performance category score, can be an important outcome tool, it should not be considered a substitute for the health utilities index.
The inter and intra-rater reliability of the CPC score has also been questioned. A cohort study of patients with out-of-hospital cardiac arrest reported poor Kappa values for classifying favorable versus unfavorable neurologic status at hospital discharge.
Yeah, and there was another study that looked both at out-of-hospital and in-hospital cardiac arrest patients. and the inter-rater reliability of the cerebral performance category score. They too found poor kappa values, suggesting substantial variability in determining neurologic outcomes. This could introduce some fuzziness around that CPC score point estimate of effect size.
Of course, your favorite number, Ken, is the number 5, right? So our fifth talking nerdy point here is the time to intervention. The time to administering the study drug seemed to lag behind the administration of epinephrine. Mean time to epinephrine administration was 5 minutes for both groups, while the study drug administration occurred at 8 minutes in the study group versus 9 minutes in the placebo group. Based on the times presented in the paper and advanced cardiac life support protocols, a subset of patients may have received multiple doses of epinephrine prior to receiving the study combination. This is a clinically relevant difference between the groups that is not accounted for and may change our ability to measure a treatment effect.
And of course, the most important word in that fifth nerdy point was may, which could be substituted with may not. But that's enough nerdiness, Neil. It's time to comment on the author's conclusions and compare them to the SGEM's conclusion.
So we generally agree with the author's conclusions.
Well, can you give an SGEM bottom line?
Sure. So I think we agree, Ken, that the routine use of vasopressors and steroids in addition to epinephrine cannot be recommended based on available evidence in patients with in-hospital cardiac arrests. However, if your goal is survival with good neurologic outcomes, our current strategy using epinephrine doesn't look all that great either. So we definitely need more work in this area.
Yeah, and I think the key word in that paragraph is routine. It doesn't mean you can't use it. Remember that evidence-based medicine has three pillars, and two of those pillars come into play here because the patient's unconscious. But we have the literature which informs and guides our care, but we still need to add our clinical judgment. So in your good clinical judgment, you may or may not decide to include vasopressors and steroids in a particular resuscitation. How about a case resolution there, Neil?
With this case, you're thinking about the causes of pulseless electrical activity arrest, PEA arrest. You obtain a stat glucometer reading and find out this man is hypoglycemic. An amp of D50 is given, which aborts the arrest. Further blood work is obtained and reported, showing he is also mildly acidotic and hyperkalemic. He is moved to a higher level of care in the hospital, and the internist takes over his care to address his ongoing glucose, pH, and electrolyte management.
So, Neil, how are you going to take this new trial and apply it clinically in your practice?
So, we still don't have high-quality, clinically relevant information to support the use of a vasopressor, steroid, and epinephrine protocol in patients with in-hospital cardiac arrest. Now, like you alluded to, Ken, that doesn't mean VSC protocol should never be used, and it will depend on the clinician's judgment. We're now left with a difficult choice, deciding on which drugs can help us resuscitate someone while preserving their quality of life. And more, it seems that these goals are at odds with each other.
So what are you going to tell your patient?
Hopefully, I'm going to tell my patient, you probably don't remember me, and you might not believe me when I tell you this, but you had a cardiac arrest. It's very nice to be able to speak with you.
Oh, that was a nice way to end the case. All right. Time for the Keener contest. There was no winner this week. Check out the SGEM blog for the correct answer. And Neil, what's the Keener contest question for this week?
So the question is, where did the term code blue originate?
Code blue. Code blue. Code blue.
Well, if you know the answer to this Keener contest question, then send an email to the SGEM at gmail.com. The first correct answer will receive a cool skeptical prize. Neil, I don't know. I think you lived up to Suchi's previous appearance. I think you did a great job.
Thank you so much. That's very kind of you. But I have to say, Ken, I'm a little bit disappointed. We got through a whole episode and there were no Princess Bride references.
Inconceivable!
We didn't talk about Monty Python at all.
I'm not dead.
You could have said, you know, in the case scenario,
well, it just so happens that your friend here is only mostly dead.
Mostly dead? He's slightly alive.
You know, I feel like this is a whole different podcast.
Hey, one other thing. This just happened. We have a new team for SGEM Global. That is a team out of Portugal, and they are translating the SGEM content into Portuguese now. And so if you go to the homepage for the SGEM, along the right-hand side, partway down, you will see an icon for SGEM Global. Click on the icon. You will get to the four other languages that the SGEM is currently published in. And that is French, German, Spanish, and Portuguese. Because knowledge translation should not have language barriers. We want patients to get the best care based on the best evidence. So we're trying to do that with the SGEM Portugal team. Anyways, thanks again, Neil. And the last thing we need you to do is to read the SGEM tagline.
Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next time.